Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, can the Suns continue their surprising season?
And will we get a wildflower super bloom this spring after a wet fall?
But first, the partial federal government shutdown is poised to move into its second week over the weekend as Democrats and Republicans disagree over funding for the Department of Homeland Security. At issue, potential changes to how federal immigration agents carry out their work and the oversight of those actions. This follows the shooting deaths of two U.S. citizens, Renee Good and Alex Preddy, by federal agents in Minneapolis. With me now to talk about the prospects for a deal is Democratic Congressman Greg Stanton. Congressman, good morning.
Good to be here.
So where are we in terms of trying to come to an agreement on what to do with DHS?
Well, the Democrats have presented to the White House a counterproposal to what the White House had originally proposed as a solution to this. But the bottom line is this. All that we are asking for is what the American people desperately are asking for. And that is that ICE behave like a professional law enforcement organization. If you're going to be out on the streets with guns and loaded weapons, you're going to be enforcing the law, you have to do it appropriately. Take the masks off so that we can have transparency, have body cameras on, which is important for accountability and transparency. Let's have a code of conduct, just like a Phoenix law enforcement would do. If you're going to arrest somebody, go get a warrant for it, an appropriate judicial warrant for it. And if you engage in violence and somebody gets hurt or killed, like tragically happened multiple times in Minnesota, two of our fellow Americans were killed, there should be an independent investigation so that the American public have confidence that they're going to get the full and true story. Those are not radical things. They're what we would expect of our local law enforcement, and it's exactly what you'd expect from ICE if they're going to behave like law enforcement officers roaming the streets of America.
We've heard from some Republicans in Congress that they're on board, some of them, with body camera, for example. But, for example, you know, taking the masks off, having identification. It seems like a fair number of Republicans are not on board with that. This seems like a pretty sort of fundamental disagreement. You think this should happen. The other side thinks it shouldn't happen. Like, how do you try to come to a deal on that?
Well, the American people are going to continue to speak loud and clear. They don't want a secret police in the United States of America. That when we see that happen in other countries, it doesn't go well. We are America, and we expect that if you're going to be a law enforcement officer, that you have your badge and you have the identity of the organization that you are with, and you operate professionally, you are well trained, and that you have accountability if things happen and people question whether or not the right decisions were made by those law enforcement officials. Again, those are not controversial. By the way, the other departments like TSA, we should fund right now. Those should not be used as leverage by either side. And I think that Democrats have offered to fund all of the other departments from Department of Homeland Security. And let's just focus in on ICE because that's really where the problems are. And the Republicans should take us up on that offer to make sure that everyone in that department gets paid now and receives pay in the current times. And let's deal with ICE, which is really the challenging issue.
Kind of along those lines, not necessarily related to the funding, though. I know you're concerned about the facility in Surprise that we and so many others have been talking about. Obviously not part of your district, but part of the Valley. I'm curious what you make of your colleague, Congressman Gosar's letter to the Homeland Security Secretary asking some questions about what's going on here.
He and I are asking the exact same questions. I was actually very happy to see his letter challenging a lot of the decisions that were made by DHS and purchasing that facility. They didn't talk to anybody. DHS didn't talk to the mayor, didn't talk to the council, didn't talk to the local school district, didn't talk to the nearby neighborhood. If this wasn't the federal government, then the city would say, hell no, you can't go there. That's a totally inappropriate site for the business that's going to be going on there. The community, both Republicans and Democrats, are angry about the fact that DHS did this secretly. And when they finally told the public about it, it was kind of a done deal. The city normally would have a chance to go in there and have building inspectors go in there and make sure that the building is ready for life safety issues. They're going to have 1,500 detainees in there. On top of that, a tremendous number of employees at well. That's at a level of intensity that was never designed for that site. And the federal government shouldn't come in and say, we're exempted from you know, the city of surprise standards for any other business. So people are rightfully very angry. And on top of that, the American people don't want this mass deportation policy that we're seeing. The American people expect that Homeland Security and ICE is going to go after people with violent criminal records, targeted enforcement. Instead, they're seeing something very different. And they're angry about it. They don't think that's the right way, the right approach. And the buying these facilities in surprise and all around the country only means that they're going to be ramping up this mass deportation policy. And that's going to anger the American people, rightfully so.
Have you or Congressman Gosar gotten answers to any of the questions you've been asking?
Not yet. No. And we put a deadline of in the very near future to get those answers. By the way, the mayor and council are asking the exact same questions mm-hmm. as well. This is bipartisan anger about this decision, and in a bipartisan way, we are demanding answers, the very same answers that we would expect from anyone putting in a development of this type. It's not zoned for it. The city's not going to have an opportunity to inspect the building and provide what's called a certificate of occupancy, which means it guarantees that it is safe for human beings who are going to be staying there. This is a potentially dangerous situation, and that is why the neighborhood, the school district, the community, and elected officials from both parties are expressing anger about this.
Do you get the sense at this point it's a done deal, even without those questions being answered?
No, I don't think it's a done deal. Look, there's going to be continued pressure on them to not move forward with this. There's going to be continued pressure on them to answer questions about life safety and the ability of life safety. But also, I think there's going to be answered questions nationally about whether the approach that they've been taking is the right approach. Look, there's a reason why Kristi Noem got fired from overseeing the Minnesota operation. She was a horrific leader of that organization. Two of our fellow Americans died because she oversaw an entity that was putting untrained agents out on the streets with deadly weapons without the training, experience, and or policies to protect the public. You know what they did, the Trump administration did? Because the American people rose up and said, hell no. They have moved back on that. I think the same thing could happen easily on a national level where the American people say that this mass deportation, the expansion of this mass deportation policy is not the right policy. Then, and Trump and his team are going to hear from even Republicans saying, you got to knock this off. And I think in the not too distant future, a lot of these facilities that they bought around the country are going to be for sale for other purposes.
Interesting. All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Arizona Congressman Greg Stanton. Congressman, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Maricopa County Recorder Justin Heap was in the hot seat yesterday after being subpoenaed by the Board of Supervisors to testify and answer to claims of voter disenfranchisement made by his staff that have stoked election denialism concerns ahead of the 2026 midterms. But Heap admitted there was no voter disenfranchisement happening now, potentially putting his chief of staff in a tricky position. Supervisors say Heap has been stonewalling for months, refusing to answer questions until they took the unprecedented step of forcing him to appear. KJZZ's Wayne Shetsky was at the hearing and joins us now to tell us more. Good morning, Wayne.
Good morning.
Okay, so let's just start with this big headline here. Justin Heap said there is no voter disenfranchisement happening right now. What did he say about some of the concerns he and his staff have raised about elections in Maricopa County?
As you said, he kind of walked back just to remind people in court, they've got this ongoing dispute between the board and the recorder. Some of his staff said that disenfranchisement is happening now because they aren't getting certain resources and things they said they need mm-hmm. To process provisional ballots, which mm-hmm. are these ballots that can't be immediately verified and someone has to maybe bring in their ID or something like that. Well, now Heap is saying, no, not happening now, not happening under my office. He still made some claims that it happened under previous offices. However, it didn't provide any proof of that. He did hand over a bunch of documents to the board that we weren't allowed to see because they hadn't had time to be redacted yet for the public. So, but he never said anything in his testimony saying, hey, but, and we've got the evidence here to show it. Mm-hmm. He just said, that's what we're saying. So it, like you said, puts his chief of staff in a tricky position. He was one of the ones who made those claims in court.
Right. So what does that potentially mean for him?
Well, I mean, again, not a lawyer, not a judge, but I can't imagine the judge will be very happy to see that testimony made in his court under oath was then Heap was also under oath before the board was then kind of contradicted.
But he kind of maintains that this has happened in the past, this thread of like, you know, there have been problems with Maricopa County elections. What does he say those problems are?
Well, so in this specific instance where this whole disenfranchisement thing came out of, again, is they're saying they need this machine that will help them sort these provisional ballots faster, and that in the event they don't have it, there's concern in a larger election that they won't be able to sort them fast enough. And so if people are coming in trying to cure or essentially get their ballots validated, they won't be able to do it fast enough by the deadlines. And so that's where this whole confusion came in, where in court, I quote, Sam Stone said, this would cause voter disenfranchisement, which is happening now. Mm-hmm. That's what he said. Mm-hmm. Now Heap is more saying that if you guys don't give us this machine, this is going to happen mm-hmm. in the future when we have a big general election.
Right. Okay. So this is all coming out in court, as you're saying, because there is this ongoing dispute that started before Heap took office, really, about who gets to control elections in Maricopa County. This so-called election shared election services agreement, right?
Yeah. And so Arizona law is very kind of weird in that it doesn't give control of elections to one office or one board. It splits election control in counties between the Board of Supervisors and the recorder. And then there's certain duties that are kind of left to either side. And so historically, counties, not just Maricopa County, have these shared agreements where the board and the recorder come together and say, you know, we're going to do this, you're going to do that. And then of these things that can go either way, we're going to take this one, you're going to take that one. The agreement agreed to before Heap took office with outgoing recorder Richer kind of shifted some of those responsibilities back to the board. Mm. Heap saw it as a way to take away his power. And the board and him have basically been trying to hash out a new agreement since he took office in January. And he ultimately filed a lawsuit trying to get back what he believes are his powers.
All right. Okay. So what did we learn yesterday about where all of that stands now, that kind of dispute over who gets concerns here? What did Heap say before the board? Did they get any further to reaching an agreement here?
So Heap's testimony was really isolated just to the claims he had made previously, but it basically doesn't seem like we're anywhere closer to an agreement. You know, he really went at the board and he accused them of basically just meddling with his office.
Let's hear a little bit of that.
I don't think that it is inappropriate for me to say that this reaches to the level of administrative interference.
So Heap continues, Wayne, to claim that the board kind of usurped his election powers, essentially. What did the board members have to say?
Well, they said, you know, that we got to bring you before us because you're refusing to answer our questions. And ultimately, we have to work together to do these elections. So, you know, board chair Thomas, or former board chair, who is now a supervisor, Thomas Galvin, said basically, like, we just need you to answer these questions so you can hash this agreement out. But instead, you just keep trying to sue us.
Mm. Let's hear what he had to say.
Do you want your recorder to go back to court every day for the next 3 months to waste your tax dollars instead of sitting here and guaranteeing that he can work with this board to do right by you?
Okay, so Wayne, this all happened with the idea that the board could remove Heap from office, kind of hanging over it, that something the board never said they would do, right? But there were certainly, it seems like, a lot of supporters of Heap there yesterday who were worried that they would take some kind of action against him.
Yeah, the law that they cited in order to force him to testify also includes an enforcement mechanism that they could remove county officers from office if they refused to testify. Well, Heap testified, number one, so mm-hmm. he kind of fulfilled that duty. But there was a lot of chatter online, some activist Heap supporters saying this is the whole point. They're just doing this so they can remove him. And so that ginned up a lot of anger, especially amongst kind of the grassroots activists. So a bunch of them showed up with that in mind. And again, it didn't really come up. Board Chair Brophy McGee said at one point, you know, everything on Twitter isn't true. And so, that it was kind of much ado about nothing.
All right. So underlying all of this is kind of this history of election denialism in the Republican Party under President Donald Trump since the 2020 election. Like, Heap never, as a candidate when he was running for this office, like outright claimed that the 2020 election was stolen or anything like that. But he has raised concerns about how elections are run here. And then we had, you know, just last week, the Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem here in Arizona claiming that elections are flawed in the state. I wonder if this conversation, this debate, could be a preview of what we might see happen in November as we head in toward another election.
Definitely. I mean, there's already been concerns raised by the board that Heap's being too aggressive with signature verification, for instance. We saw a much higher rate of rejected ballots due to that. And also, you know, he just came out after Noem's visit and said that he scanned that big list of voters who's may not have provided proof of citizenship. Mm-hmm. You know, the big issue we had last year where, you know, because of the old driver's licenses and all that. I won't rehash the whole thing. But he said of that list of 60,000+ people in Maricopa County, he did identify 137 people who were on the rolls and shouldn't have been, and including, I believe, 60 or so who have voted in an election. this is another issue with politics getting into these into elections, because that's something that both sides can claim a victory on. You know, the people who say non-citizens are voting can point to that and say non-citizens are voting, though I will say that the database he used has a history of being inaccurate. But the people on the other side can say, we never said this never happens. We're saying it's increasingly rare and it doesn't affect elections. And if you look at 60,000 plus people and 60 of them voted, that is a very minuscule number and unlikely to influence the outcome of any individual election. So it's one of those things where if those numbers are accurate, both sides can claim victory, and we're kind of right back where we started.
Right back where we started, right. KJZZ's Wayne Shetsky joining us from our politics desk. Wayne, thanks as always.
Yep, thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, Arizona saw a lot of rain in the fall. Are we due for another super bloom?
But first, homeschooling is becoming more popular in Arizona and across the country. This is for a lot of reasons, from the pandemic to the rise of school choice and school vouchers to the advent of parents' rights and a new sense that people want to have a hand in what their kids learn. In fact, homeschooling has increased at a rate of more than 5% across the country in the last year, according to research from Johns Hopkins. That's nearly three times the pre-pandemic rate of around 2%. Last month on the show, we heard from Queen Creek mom of four, Brooke Bentley, about her experience homeschooling her kids as a progressive parent. Bentley, who runs a secular homeschool enrichment group, said support programs for homeschoolers like the ESA program, school vouchers, have been a net positive for parents seeking more individualized learning for their kids.
At PATH, a good chunk of them are homeschooling because they have a neurodivergent child. And if that's not the case, a lot of them are homeschooling because they want the family time. They want more time with their kids. You know, we send our kids to public school and they come home and they do their extracurriculars and it's dinner and bedtime. And I think parents are just kind of feeling like they're missing out on a large chunk of their kids' childhood and then always more individualized learning.
So today, let's turn to someone who sees this issue a little differently. Tess Ulrey is executive director of the Coalition for Responsible Home Education. She was homeschooled herself and didn't have a bad experience, but today she is a public school mom and advocates for oversight of homeschooling, especially as it's gaining steam.
Homeschooling growing as an education modality across the country and for all sorts of different reasons. I think when we think about, you know, historic homeschooling, we assume white, religious, kind of religiously motivated homeschoolers.
Yeah.
And that is changing. The face of homeschooling is changing. So I think as families realize, and frankly, COVID changed a lot of stuff for a lot of us, right?
Yeah.
Even when we got more flexible with education there, now people are accessing homeschooling for all sorts of different reasons. Sometimes it's for neurodivergency. Sometimes it's because they're dissatisfied with what's happening in the public school system, or those kind of traditional motivations still exist as well.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about some of the oversight that your organization advocates for. Like, give us some examples of some of the policies you think are important to have in place when, and especially right now as we're seeing homeschooling grow.
Absolutely. I think that we need to look at policy in sort of two buckets. We like to look at policy from a kind of a child safety component. So some of the things that we advocate for are more interaction for homeschooled children with mandated reporters, as well as some safety requirements for who is homeschooling them. The other piece of advocacy that we do is for resources. Arizona does a great job of making sure that homeschoolers can access things through the public school system, but that is not the case across the country. Mm. So it's important to us to talk about the resources side of it too, for homeschoolers to be able to participate just like other kids do, but also things like standardized tests, AP classes, that's all important for a well-rounded student.
You think that homeschooling kids should be required to take those same kind of tests so that we know what they're learning, if they're meeting benchmarks, that kind of thing?
Yeah, our organization's a big fan of that of that benchmarking. And that comes from, of course, you know, a larger educational lens. But also, we're an alumni-founded and an alumni-powered organization. We know that as alumni ourselves and the alumni we work with now, especially when children are outside of the public school system or that traditional school system, it's really important for us to know, you know, how do we measure up with our peers? What can be our next steps? And so we definitely advocate for that benchmarking, whether that's standardized tests or portfolio reviews, but some way to know that we're on track.
Hmm. You mentioned cases of abuse, things like making sure that kids are around mandatory reporters once in a while. What do those kind of policies look like from your point of view?
From our point of view, there is not a state that does enough to take some kind of common sense steps towards preventing abuse and neglect within the homeschool community. Right now in Arizona, an individual convicted of violent crimes against children is actually allowed to homeschool their own children. Hmm. For us, those kind of things are a red flag when we're thinking about basic child safety measures.
That's interesting. So there's not a law that regulates that. Have we seen that happen before? Is that a problem?
So that's difficult to answer because there are cases across the country where an unsafe individual and, you know, kind of deemed unsafe by the court system has seriously abused a homeschool child. It's hard for us to say, yes, that happened in Arizona and it's happening in Arizona, but we know across the country that it has.
So talk about the ESA system here. This is the kind of universal school voucher program. It is the most robust in the country. It's a boon to homeschooling, you think, right?
I think it is. I think what it does is open up some access for families who may not be able to homeschool. Frankly, a lot of homeschooling is rooted in a certain amount of privilege. For me, I actually never considered even homeschooling my own children because I was a single mom. Hmm. So I needed to work. Homeschooling was never going to be an option for me, right? But when we start thinking about community supports and things like ESAs, you know, that now some of the financial pressure's off and maybe that would be the best fit for a child. So I think it gives families, you know, kind of that additional lever that's so important when we all just want to find the best way for our own child to learn.
So do we require testing or benchmarks of homeschooled kids in our state though?
Loosely is probably the best way to answer that. When people are involved in the ESA program, there's some of that natural accountability that comes back and forth. However, participation in ESA is by no means required, right? Mm. So there are families in Arizona, plenty of families in Arizona, who choose not to access the ESA program because they don't want that oversight and that accountability. Mm. What we would like to see is the state look holistically at all homeschooled children, whether or not they're accessing some of those ESA programs, and put some of those assessments and benchmarks into place.
I'm sure you know the politics around this are heated, especially in a state like Arizona that's been such a pioneer in school choice. I think whenever regulations, oversight, you know, that kind of language is used around something like homeschooling, people are going to prickle.
Absolutely. I think one of the strongest voices in this is the parents' rights movement. You know, it's parents' right to educate their child however they see fit. We actually approach this work from a child-centered lens. So we talk a lot about a children's right to education, mm-hmm. a children's right to a safe home. And the reality is that some of these legislative safeguards need to be in place for that to happen equitably across all children.
Let me ask you a question about that idea of testing and standardized tests for kids who are homeschooled. I spoke with a mom on our show recently who is a homeschooling parent and kind of runs a collective for progressive homeschooling parents here in the Valley. And she said most of the students in their program are there because they're neurodivergent. And she used this phrase a lot that like one size fits all education just doesn't work for a lot of kids. When it comes to that kind of population, like, do you think it's fair to require the same kinds of standards for them?
So we actually would prefer something called a portfolio review, because I think that speaks a little bit better to how, you know, the how and the why of homeschooling, right? It's a unique education system. A lot of these children are learning in different ways. But in the states that have the successful portfolio review, it allows the homeschooled children to maybe show a writing sample, talk to a teacher. It's one of those things that might meet the needs a little bit better than standardized testing. Hmm. The piece of standardized testing for us that we know comes in strongly is especially when homeschoolers want to access college or secondary education.
Right. So it sounds like you're not, when you say you're not anti-homeschooling, you understand that it can be really valuable for a lot of parents. It doesn't even sound like you're anti-school vouchers. You think that can be valuable for a lot of these families. What I wonder is how you strike some sort of middle ground for folks, like in this kind of very hotly debated political moment in which, you know, homeschooling and parents' rights and school choice and all of these phrases are really kind of nuclear sometimes. Do you think there's a way to regulate these things that doesn't feel like an infringement on parental rights?
Yeah, I think that there's a couple things that need to happen. I think there needs to be a better understanding from the public about what homeschooling is, you know, and who homeschoolers are. For me and for a lot of other alumni, sometimes we are the most keenly aware of some of the stereotypes around homeschooling. So I think there's an amount of education that is needed to sort of break some of those stereotypes. And at the same time, the homeschool population needs to become a little bit more realistic about what the public school system is like, too. There's a lot of fear on both sides of this conversation that I think can be addressed. Those are absolutely challenging conversations. And the other piece that I think is important to bring into this is homeschooling became legal really in like the mid-90s. I'll date myself a little bit. I'm 37 years old. So I was first homeschooled when it became legal in the state of Michigan in 1996. And, you know, so now there is a bulk of alumni, right? And our voices need to count in this as well. It's great there's so many parents that want to homeschool, but we can be such a resource in that to make sure that it's successful because we lived through it.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Tess Ulrey is Executive Director of the Coalition for Responsible Home Education, joining us to talk about homeschooling. Tess, thank you very much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. The disappearance of Nancy Guthrie has dominated headlines over the last several weeks. And that means Pima County Sheriff Chris Nanos has been contending with the harsh glare of the national spotlight. Some of Nanos's investigative decisions have drawn criticism, as have his public appearances, both official and otherwise. In one of his first press conferences, Nanos said, quote, "I'm not used to everyone hanging on to my every word and then holding me accountable for what I say," end quote. The comment raised eyebrows. Many, including Arizona Daily Star columnist Tim Steller, winced at the idea that an elected official and lead investigator on a high-profile case would say such a thing. But as Steller tells our co-host Sam Dingman, moments like that are kind of par for the course when it comes to covering Sheriff Nanos.
I think those of us who know him kind of know not to take everything word for word as truth. We maybe know how to interpret him a little bit more than people who haven't spoken to him before.
Uh-huh. Right.
But overall, you know, I think in those first two press conferences he held in the first week, I think a lot of people were left wondering, like, who is this guy around the country, of course, outside of Pima County, because he came off eager to answer questions, but also sometimes, I don't know, it felt a little unprofessional at times.
I'm wondering how you balance that against the way that he seems to be handling the case, because it seems like one of the other issues that you're sort of alluding to in the answer you just gave is the way that he messages about this, even if nothing technically incorrect has happened, also kind of doesn't inspire confidence.
Yeah, I mean, he speaks off the cuff. And one thing I'll give him credit for is, like, when he's asked a question, he hears the question and he answers it. I hate to even suggest this as a journalist, but he probably would be better served to be more taciturn in that respect. But that's not his style. You know, he's right. Never been that way.
Yeah. What is your sense, Tim, of how these controversies related to Nanos's performance around the Guthrie case are playing locally? Because obviously you've written your column. There was also a piece on the news recently about Nanos showing up at a basketball game, and some people thought he should have been working on the case instead of being at the basketball game.
You know, of course, opinion is divided. I do think that there's widespread questioning. Mm-hmm. And of course, the longer it takes to resolve the case, the more the questioning grows. What we don't know is whether anything he's done has affected the outcome of the case. For example, they kept the house sealed, that is, in the hands of the sheriff's department for the first couple of days. I'm talking here about the home of Nancy Guthrie. And then after that, they released the home to the family. Well, after that happened, some journalists walked up to the door and some other people basically made themselves present on the scene. And then the sheriff's department sealed the house again 2 days later. So that could have screwed up any evidence that they might have found on the scene thereafter.
Right.
That's the sort of thing that people locally are just, you know, maybe wincing at a little bit. But we don't know how this is all going to turn out. Mm-hmm. And we certainly don't know everything that's going on behind the scenes. They might be doing as well as they could. It's just that when you see little things like this, it makes you think they aren't.
Yeah. Well, you were mentioning, Tim, that the way Nanos has been speaking in things like press conferences. You know, to folks who are just becoming familiar with him, it might be surprising. To you, who's been covering him for a while, it's not as surprising. What about something like that issue with the crime scene? Did that seem in character with Nanos as sheriff insofar as you've been observing him, or did it feel like that was out of character?
Well, we really don't usually pay this close attention to an investigation. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I really wouldn't know if they've sealed the scene and then unsealed it and then resealed it before, because rarely do we pay that close attention to any investigation they're carrying out.
Yeah.
You know, this is one of those situations where every single move is being analyzed and speculated about by people around the country. And so, while it does undermine perhaps local confidence in him, it's possible we're just seeing something, seeing the way things work normally play out in a much more public fashion.
Yeah. Well, this gets to something else that you write about in your piece, which is this idea of who is controlling the narrative in this case, Nanos or the FBI or TMZ or people following the case from afar in sort of new media ways, podcasters, vloggers, streamers. There was this one incident that you write about where a podcaster, I think it was, identified Nancy Guthrie's son-in-law as a suspect. He was not, in fact, considered a suspect by Nanos's office, but the perception that he was got out of hand very quickly, right?
Right. I mean, so what we're seeing here is this new information environment showing how powerful it is. You know, a streamer from some other part of the country who shows up here may have 10 times the audience of all the news outlets in Tucson put together. And so his careless speculation about what's going on may get a lot more attention nationwide or worldwide than whatever more responsible journalistic outlets are saying. And to a large degree, more than any other local story I've seen, this is who's controlling the narrative. It's the streamers, the YouTubers, the posters, you know, people just doing their armchair detective work. Yeah. And as a result, the information is a free-for-all.
Right, right. Well, and of course, the longer the case goes unsolved by mm-hmm. Nanos and the FBI, the more room there is for folks in that world to continue kind of breadcrumbing things into increased lack of clarity.
Yep. And but also increased hits. I mean, that, you know,
right.
We're talking about
yeah,
people who are making money on the number of viewers they have on YouTube or whatever. So, you know, accuracy may not be what is paying off for people. It's just entertainment value.
Yeah. It does make me want to ask you, though, Tim. I mean, it seems like one of the things we're kind of dancing around here is this idea that one of the responsibilities of being sheriff in a situation like this, where Pima County finds itself in the spotlight, is in addition to being a good law enforcement officer, a good investigator, there's increasingly in this media environment the necessity of being a good steward of the narrative, a good storyteller.
Yeah, I mean, there are people who are more skilled at that and people who are less skilled at that. Nanos is plenty skilled at talking and likes to talk, and I think that's fine, but he's not skilled at crafting a narrative and sticking to it and also presenting like a reassuring presence on the national stage. So, you know, that's who he is. And, you know, we don't know what's going on in the background, but it would be nice if the person in charge were a better steward, as you say, of the narrative.
Well, I have been speaking with Tim Steller, opinion columnist for the Arizona Daily Star. Tim, thank you as always.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. The Phoenix Suns start the post-All-Star break portion of their schedule tonight when they take on the San Antonio Spurs in Texas. The Suns have a record of 32-23 and are in seventh place in the Western Conference, currently in position to make the play-in tournament. That leaves them only four wins short of their total from all of last year when they missed the playoffs altogether.
Their 32 wins also exceeds the preseason predictions of many observers for how many games the team would win over the course of the season. So what's behind the Suns' surprising success so far this season, and can they keep it up and make the playoffs? With me to discuss is Law Murray, NBA writer for The Athletic. And Law, first off, how surprised are you at where the Suns are right now?
It's very surprising to me. It's not just even about this year's team. The previous teams that the Suns have had with so much more talent, all underachieved, all of them. Even the one seed that they had back in 2022, that team didn't make it to the conference finals. And I believe that was the best regular season in Suns history or close to it. So ever since then, they've had Kevin Durant in the playoffs and they won one playoff series in 2 years with Kevin. The expectations that I have for the Suns team was that they were going to be safely in the bottom five of the Western Conference. And instead, they've looked like this year what the LA Clippers looked like a year before. So a big shout out to Devin Booker for holding things down and Jordan Ott for what he's been able to implement with that team in his first year as an NBA head coach.
Okay, so how much do you attribute to Devin Booker sort of being Devin Booker and Jordan Ott's, you know, approach and what he's been able to do as the coach in relation to everything else that's sort of gone on with the Suns? I guess, like, what do you attribute the fact that they're so much better than you and so many others thought they would be?
Defense. Jordan Ott coming from the Cleveland staff, I mean, I didn't even think of what he would do to shape Phoenix's defense. Because Cleveland was the best offense in the NBA last year. And I felt like, okay, well, you're going to get some heavy pick and roll because that's kind of what Cleveland did. But the great thing about basketball and your opportunity to coach basketball is that your specialties aren't always as black and white as they are like in football, right? Basketball is a lot more checkers compared to the chess of football. And so the Suns being a strong defense, especially how they defended last year, like I didn't see it with the personnel that they had. I didn't think that Jordan Ott would be the reason that they would come in and defend at a high level. I will give Dylan Brooks a lot of credit for that energy. Mm-hmm. And so there's that. But I will say that that team doesn't pop off the page offensively. You have to give the Phoenix Suns credit as far as their turnaround goes for being a top 10 defense at this point of the season and for an identity with that defense. Like, they're going to foul you. They're going to hit you. But they're also going to take the ball away from you. And that is half the battle to being good, is you have to understand what your route to being good is and then commit to that consistently. And here we are 2/3 into the regular season and they've done that.
Do you see this team and maybe some of their success as maybe being the kind of team where the sum is greater than the parts, as opposed to past years where, you know, as you alluded to, they've tried to do sort of the big three thing and it didn't really work out that well?
You always are going to have a team that brings the most out of everybody who gets an opportunity to contribute. And to your point, those guys were supposed to be good last year and the year before that, and even the year before that, coming off of the finals because of the star level talent that they had. And when you don't have that, sometimes it's easier to lock in on what you need to do to compete and win. There was so much to look at and say, if those Suns teams couldn't do it, this Suns team won't do it. And that's what's inspiring about what the Suns have been able to show to this point in the season. Like, a guy like Colin Gillespie has emerged. A guy like Dylan Brooks, it feels like Dylan Brooks is always better when he is able to take as many shots as he wants, and he's been able to do that. Like, Devin Booker needs somebody to help him with that offensive workload, and Dylan Brooks has been more than up for it. They take a ton of threes. Again, that's the kind of influence that you see from the Phoenix Suns or the Cleveland Cavaliers, that Jordan Ott kind of came from that staff and that way of playing. So when you don't have a certain level when it comes to personnel, when it comes to talent, guys know that. Guys know what league they're in. And they know that if you're going to compete, you're going to have to play over that, and you're going to have to do things harder. And I don't think anyone's questioned the effort of the Phoenix Suns this year. I think the internal expectations for the Suns was to compete. Like, the bar was low. Like, you have a first-year head coach. You strip down your roster. You don't really have future assets. Just try hard and see what happens. And they've done that.
So, understanding that crystal balls are often cloudy, how sustainable do you think this is for the Suns, at least through the rest of this this season?
Well, the good news is, again, we're in the third quarter of the season. We're not through the third quarter, but we're in it. You're firmly in the second half of the regular season already.
Yeah.
They're at this point where they should be getting better, to be honest with you. Devin Booker's going to have a little bit more health. Jalen Green hopefully is healthier now than he was in the first half of the year, and that should help a lot. Like, Jalen Green's a talented player. He's a messy player, but he's a talented player. And you need guys who can be comfortable with the ball in their hands and to get you through the regular season. The concern will be for the playoffs, but I think if the Suns make the playoffs, they're playing with house money. And they're in a position where they're going to have a great shot to make the playoffs. They are seventh in the Western Conference. It is not outside the question for them to rise as high as third. They're not going to get there, but, you know, like, yeah. If you only have three fewer losses than the team currently in third, then you go out and you say, well, why can't we do that? You know, they're as close to third place as they are to eighth place. So they are very relevant in the Western Conference. All these games are going to matter. I will say it's not like they've played their best basketball of late. But this is a team, again, they have an identity, and having an identity is half the battle. They are very reliant on Devin Booker, but Devin Booker did miss some time in the end of January going into February. And again, he's healthier now than he was. So I think that sustainability for the Suns is just a matter of, can you put yourself in position to maybe avoid the play-in tournament? They are certainly in position to do that. Every team above them in the West is more talented than them. That's just how it is. But they also have put themselves in the spot where, even if they're in the play-in tournament, I think they're going to have a comfortable spot to clinch a playoff spot. And that's that would qualify as a successful season for this Phoenix team.
All right. That is Law Murray, an NBA writer for The Athletic. Law, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Hey, thank you.
Well, Arizona got a lot of rain last fall and into the winter, and now we're experiencing a sort of early spring where some days temperatures sit in the cloudy 60s and others we're seeing sunny 80-degree afternoons.
It's left many Arizonans wondering if we might get another wildflower super bloom like we did in 2023. And it's become kind of a hot topic here at the show. Even longtime travel writer Roger Naylor is up in the air about it.
Well, this year is different because I think it is the most confusing wildflower season I can ever recall. I mean, on the one hand, far more blooms than normal grace the desert all winter long. You know, brittlebush have been showy since December. Poppies and lupins made surprise appearances in January, joining more traditional early bloomers like fairy duster and tuberosa.
Naylor says the early winter long bloom is a result of all that autumn rain.
And then when a wave of moisture rolled in through the holidays, I mean, the stage was set. Everybody was thinking this is a potential super bloom year, but then the faucet got turned off. Because since then, conditions have stayed mostly very dry and very warm.
One expert, though, is optimistic about a potential abundance of wildflowers in the coming months, despite the early activity. Teresa Crimmins is an associate professor in the School of Natural Resources and the Environment at the University of Arizona and director of the USA National Phenology Network.
What I believe that I have been seeing this kind of like fall, winter, spring is a muddle of stuff happening because we had such a crummy monsoon. And then it finally started raining in October, which is not a season, not a month that we typically have good rains. And then it kept raining on a regular basis, and it was super warm. And so what I actually have seen is a decent number of both the plants and insects and arthropods that are typically associated with the monsoon, the summer season, finally happening in like December. I think the last summer stuff finally came online late because it finally experienced some rain. And then also combined with the very warm winter, that prompts some of the springtime stuff to come early.
Cribbins agrees that this year's wildflower season may not qualify as a super bloom per se, but it's already shaping up to be a brilliant showing.
I don't disagree that we have kind of a mixed bag of stuff happening out there, but I also think that there's still a good chance for impressive amounts of the annual plants that do seem to respond to the winter, fall, and winter rainfall. I think we're in for a treat no matter what, because when we get this much rain, something's going to flower. Lots of stuff's going to flower.
So maybe if not a super bloom, a pretty good bloom?
Let's call it that.
A pretty good bloom?
The pretty good bloom
The pretty
year.
Good bloom. We should trademark that. All right. Well, this was hopefully a pretty good show as well. Thanks for being along with us. Remember, you can always follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman.